Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
Welcome to the Athletic Football Podcast. I'm Ian Irving, and coming up today we discuss the news that broke over the weekend that Cristiano Ronaldo has told Manchester United that he wants to leave if the right offer comes in for him. We also have an exclusive from David Ornstein on the news that Christian Eriksen has verbally agreed to join United. Then our Liverpool writer James Pearce will be here with all the details of Mohamed Salah's new Liverpool contract that could see him earn close to £400,000 a week. And our women's football correspondent Charlotte Harper will help us to preview the European Championships, which start in England on Wednesday.
Stretford End, where he is at home. Ronaldo clutters it in! Without compromise, with utter certainty.
Okay, well, only one place to start, and that's Cristiano Ronaldo's future. I'm joined now by our United writer, Laurie Whitwell, who was fully across this story across the weekend. It was Saturday, wasn't it, where it first emerged that Ronaldo wanted to leave. Laurie, what's the sort of background to this before we get into whether he was at training or not today?
Yeah, quite. Very pertinent was the story by David Ornstein and assisted by Dan Sheldon a couple of weeks ago, where they revealed that Jorge Mendes had met with Chelsea and also had a conversation with Bayern Munich, and the subject of that conversation was Cristiano Ronaldo. So I suppose that was perhaps the starting gun in this potential saga that we're now seeing unfold. And then Saturday night, Duncan Castles of the Times broke the story that Ronaldo had actually informed United that he wanted to leave. So that was kind of an escalation in developments. David Ornstein then, you know, sourced that himself, and we did the story on The Athletic. And then yesterday was basically spent trying to figure out exactly what the next step would be. And as we'll get on to in terms of him turning up for training, that was kind of a key one that I think people were wondering about. But clearly, this has been something that I think has been brewing for a little while. Not the whole summer, certainly not after the end of the season. I think we felt that actually Ronaldo was okay about staying. Okay, he wasn't going to be Champions League football, but he's got the World Cup with Portugal and he wants to be playing regularly and in tip-top form for that. But I think something's changed, and the developments over the last, couple of weeks have sort of pointed towards this being a really huge story. I mean, United weren't anticipating that Cristiano Ronaldo would ask to leave.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of different aspects to this, and we'll go through them all, of course. But I think we should start with training then this morning. So he's not turned up. And what's the reason for it?
Well, listen, United are citing family reasons, and you have to respect that. Clearly, yesterday we were asking people, we got sources telling us that they didn't expect Ronaldo to turn up because that was the next step in his exit strategy. You know, if you want to leave, it's kind of textbook, really, isn't it, that you kind of make things a bit difficult for your club. Listen, we don't know the exact reasons. We do have to respect what United are saying publicly, but everybody else has shown up. I mean, all the international players were due back. Ronaldo was due back. He was expected back. And when we were having conversations with people late last night on Sunday, it became clear that United weren't even sure exactly what his plans were. So this has been a very sort of sudden development. It's not something that had been pre-organised that he wasn't going to turn up today.
Yeah, the timing as well, I guess, for Manchester United is problematic, because Ronaldo, if he'd said this at the end of the season in May, that this was his position, then obviously they would have had a hell of a lot of time to get things sorted out. Now, obviously, it's a totally different situation with the club already back in training and set to go on tour at the end of the week. What's their reaction to it? I mean, how do they feel about what's been said and the way it's been done?
Yeah, they're keeping the council. The only thing that's really coming out is that, you know, they don't entertain selling him. You know, they see he has another year on his contract. It's not been in their plans. You look at the way that they've gone about their recruitment, although they haven't actually signed anybody yet, which is kind of remarkable, you know, when we've got a few days before pre-season, it's a new manager in town. But they didn't go for a striker because they thought Cristiano Ronaldo would be that guy. And it's difficult to buy a striker if, you know, you're selling them the fact that they're going to be a backup to a guy that clearly doesn't want to ever miss a minute of football, as we saw last season, you know, the reaction at Brentford and various other circumstances where clearly Ronaldo wants to play week in, week out. So United focused their attentions elsewhere, rightly or wrongly. You know, they didn't go in for Darwin Nunez. I had a lot of Liverpool fans sort of scoff at that suggestion over the weekend when I tweeted that. Listen, Liverpool, I'm sure, would have won that race anyway. You know, they put the money down. They made their move very clearly. But the fact is, United were offered Darwin Nunez back in April and they didn't make a move for him, partly because, you know, they weren't sure about Erik ten Hag definitely wanting him, partly because they had Cristiano Ronaldo in town and, yeah, would Darwin Nunez be a support to that player? But listen, they haven't signed a striker. They've not looked to sign a striker. Whether or not that changes now with Ronaldo's, you know, desire to leave, but it doesn't really leave much room for negotiations. And clearly, the options out there aren't as varied as they were at one point previously.
No, obviously, the idea that United haven't signed someone's well publicised. It's been cited as a reason for Ronaldo maybe deciding that he doesn't want to be at Old Trafford next season. But fundamentally, what has changed between the end of the season when it sounded like Ronaldo was going to stay to now where it's becoming very clear that he doesn't?
I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, without hearing from him directly, it's a little bit speculative, but I suppose, you know, you have time to reflect, don't you, when a season finishes, you might think one way. Like I say, we thought that he was kind of okay about staying. You know, okay, he's not committed, he's not, you know, singing and dancing for the fact that he's not going to be in the Champions League next season, but, you know, kind of made
his peace with it. Do you think that's a key thing, Laurie? The Champions League bit?
Yeah, it's definitely. I mean, we saw his performance, didn't we, for United last season in the group stages, and he was like on a one-man mission, wasn't he, to avoid dropping into that Europa League sort of third place finishing position. You know, the goals that he scored last minute, you know, he kind of willed United onto the knockout phase. And he's played in that competition, you know, basically his whole adult life. You know, it's only when he was a teenager that he didn't. And so for him to be out of that, he's 37, you know, as David Ornstein reported, he sees himself as having, you know, 3-4 more years at the top, which is incredible, really, when you think about it. But you wouldn't necessarily put it past him. You know, 24 goals scored for Manchester United last season. So he views himself at that level to be playing in the Champions League. And maybe on reflection, that's what he's ultimately come down to. And as you say, United haven't made the kind of signings that I think would give confidence. Well, they haven't made any signings yet. We expect them to make signings this week for sure, but it's not like even those signings will be the ones that kind of spread incredible confidence amongst the squad that Ronaldo might have been looking for.
United are actually edging closer to signing a couple of players, possibly.
Yep, Tyrell Malacia, the Feyenoord left-back, he's in Manchester, he's at Carrington. He was there on Sunday, he's back again today, which is Monday, for his medical. So I expect that one to be announced fairly soon, you know, perhaps even in the coming day. And then also, Lisandro Martinez, who is a centre-back at Ajax, who Ten Hag has obviously worked with, knows him very well, and I think that's one that he's pushed for. I'm hearing positive noises on that. United have made a bid of €40 million guaranteed, rising to €45 million. I think Ajax are trying to hold out for about €50 million, but there's kind of positive noise about that. Arsenal are rivaling, you know, genuinely. So it's a little bit of a debate about where he goes, but he's told Ajax that he wants to move to the Premier League. I do feel like United will ultimately get that one done. And then, yeah, there's obviously other players. Frenkie de Jong, talks are still going on with him. You know, Juan Laporta has come out and said that he's not for sale and kind of playing that kind of game, which I think raised a few eyebrows in Manchester, given the talks that are going on behind the scenes. He said that kind
not
of
like
stuff.
Not like him, is it, to stir the pot?
Well, exactly, yeah. You know, Lionel Messi, I think that was the same situation with him, wasn't it? And then he ended up leaving. So, yeah, perhaps take that with a pinch of salt. But I don't know if he will, if that will get done before United fly out on Friday. I think that would be a bit of a stretch. And then obviously they've made an offer to Christian Eriksen as well.
Thanks for the update, Laurie.
Cheers, guys.
Well, whilst recording, The Athletic's David Ornstein has broken the story that Christian Eriksen has verbally agreed to join Manchester United, and David is now here to bring us more on this. David, explain.
Yeah, Ian, this was the conclusion that we were all waiting for, because Christian Eriksen had a decision to make. Who was he going to join as a free agent this summer after his Brentford contract expired, a six-month deal that I think he signed in early 2022. And he had offers from Brentford, as we revealed, Manchester United, reportedly a couple of others as well. There were some suggestions in the industry that a deadline had been set for his decision. Clubs wanted to know. And especially in the case of Manchester United, because under Erik ten Hag, they need to plan their new era, their new season, what recruitment they're going to do in and out, and are they going to have Christian Eriksen or are they going to have to look elsewhere? But it's my understanding that Christian Eriksen has now communicated to Manchester United that he wants to accept their offer of a 3-year straight contract and that he wants to play for Manchester United. Now, at this point, it is verbal, but the process of drafting contracts is now underway. And if that is finalised, they will move on to conducting medical tests, which are par for the course. They're standard for any player. But given Christian Eriksen's history, it's something that is a significant hurdle that needs to be overcome before the signing can be complete. I don't anticipate any problems on that front. And we've seen the evidence of Eriksen back playing and excelling in the Premier League and at international level. And it seems that Manchester United have almost now got their man. Not quite a done deal, but I think it is going to be done. And what a moment that is for Christian Eriksen and, of course, for Manchester United.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is good news for Manchester United fans, no doubt as well, David, especially after the conversation I've just been having with Laurie Whitwell about Cristiano Ronaldo and his future, which, of course, you've been fully across as well.
Yeah, this is a massive question that a lot of eyeballs are on for obvious reasons, because Cristiano Ronaldo came back to Manchester United to great fanfare. It was a deal that was supposed to expire in the summer of 2023. I think I'm right in saying, correct me if I'm wrong. And Ronaldo is all of a sudden saying that he wants to go now in the summer of 2022. He has informed Manchester United of his decision. You'll remember recently we published an exclusive story that his agent, George Mendes, had met with the new Chelsea co-owner, Todd Boehly, just recently. And among the subjects they discussed was Ronaldo's future and the possibility of him joining Chelsea. Now, we didn't know if Chelsea were looking to take that any further. We think that similar conversations had taken place with Bayern Munich and potentially others as well. Manchester United moved very quickly to say that Cristiano Ronaldo is not for sale, and reminded us that he's under contract until the summer of 2023. But then over the weekend in the Times, Duncan Castles broke the story that Cristiano Ronaldo has informed Manchester United that he wants to leave. We managed to corroborate that and publish it ourselves. And that's when this situation became very serious. And in subsequent phone calls and conversations around that matter, I've established that Chelsea are considering moving for Cristiano Ronaldo, given his desire to leave if suitable offers arrive to Manchester United. Now, as things stand, Manchester United are standing by their stance that Ronaldo is not for sale. Let's see if that changes. But the situation here is that Chelsea are monitoring it. It is a potential opportunity, an idea, a concept that is believed to appeal to their new hierarchy, which is led by the co-owner, the chairman, and the interim sporting director, Todd Boehly. I think and am told that he and a fellow director, Behdad Egbali, are intrigued by this possibility of signing such an iconic player from the world of football. But there are many factors involved in this. Would Manchester United at some point consider selling? Would Manchester United consider selling to a Premier League rival in Chelsea? What would the manager, the head coach of Chelsea, Thomas Tuchel, say about it? Now, it's my understanding that he is a long-term admirer of Cristiano Ronaldo, but he would have to give his blessing to the decision to sign him, because he has all of the power at Chelsea right now. He would also have to have conversations with Cristiano Ronaldo, if it came to it, on where and how he might fit into Chelsea's system and style of play. So This one, I think, has a long way to run. We also reported over the weekend that there is interest from elsewhere, including apparently Napoli, but I'm not sure how that would work financially. Whereas in the case of Chelsea, I don't think the finances would be an issue. It's more whether Manchester United would let it happen and then whether Thomas Tuchel would want it to happen. So there's never a dull moment in the life of Manchester United nor Cristiano Ronaldo.
So we expect the next 7 days to be busy at Old Trafford. We'll have the very latest, of course, on The Athletic. And there's also lots of United reading up there already, including Adam Crafton's interview with leading recruitment chief Paul Mitchell, who's admitted that he wants to return to the Premier League at some point in the future and has, of course, been linked with clubs in England, including United. We can hear some of that conversation with Adam now. And he starts by reflecting on the challenges he faced when he started in his current role as a sporting director of the French side Monaco.
When I arrived, none of this beautiful training centre was here. It's hard to put into words, and maybe we should have took some imagery of that first day. But I remember asking the head of player care to organise a meeting with the staff and the players on the pitch. And we only had one because this was very much a working building site that had stopped for COVID. So we was in cabins that was designed to be built for 2 years, but we had them from 2014. So I had a very natural shower coming in from one corner of my office, what was very much fun to work in. I remember presenting on the pitch and thinking, wow, we have one training pitch and 77 players. It was like someone had given out a flyer to come and train at AS Monaco for one day. So that posed naturally some initial short-term problems. How are we even going to stagger the training? How are we even going to house all of these professionals in COVID with the restrictions and protocols that we needed to put medically in place? So straight away, you're really in the deep end and you have to sort through that, trying to best to make a assessment of the quality of the player, the profile of the player, the type of player, while building the team in our reflection of how we want the game to be played. Not missing a talent or maybe a young talent that you've inherited and you don't know so much about. So really long days, a lot of work. Very fortunate to have the experience of the technical director, Lawrence Stewart, that knew them from a recruitment perspective and their journeys and histories to make them critical decisions. But yeah, to say it was a baptism of fire day one or week one was probably an understatement.
You'll be aware, your reputation in England is getting bigger and bigger. There's like relentless speculation about United, Chelsea being interested in you. Has there been anything in that at all?
I think the way I look at it is similar to the way I look at anything we do here. If there's speculation with the size of organisations that both of the clubs you mentioned are, I think it can only be seen as a positive for myself and for Monaco. That shows that we're doing a good job. We're disturbing the market in a good way. I think that would be a nice way that I reflect on that. And, you know, you can never say never. You know, I am from England. I think definitely one day, I think I'm still relatively a young man, even though I look a lot older. I will clearly go back to the Premier League and to friends and family over there as well. But I'm still enjoying the work. And while the agreements are in place between me and the major shareholder in particular and the board of ways of working, processes of working still stand, I suspect that I'm still going to be here. But I see it as a great reflection, not only to me, but all of the great colleagues I work with every day, that, you know, brands like that are mentioned in the same sentence as myself.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to michelobultra.com/courtside to learn more.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Salah. He's done it again. Mo Salah. Still Salah.
Right, our Liverpool writer James Pearce joins us now on the news that broke on Friday that Mohamed Salah has signed a new 3-year contract at the club. I mean, this is definitely welcome news, James, no doubt about it. It was a bit of a saga, in fairness. What was the breakthrough?
The breakthrough in the end was a significantly improved offer from Liverpool's owners. You know, you're right, it had been a protracted and at times acrimonious saga, kind of really going back to the summer of 2020 when Salah's agent first hoped that the club would open talks about a new contract. It was the following year, 2021, before those discussions really got underway. And then, certainly around the turn of the year when Rami Abbas had flown out to Miami to meet FSG president Mike Gordon, we know that at that point there was a big gulf between, what was on the table and what was being demanded. And, as that kind of went, just rolled on through the second half of the season, I think, not surprisingly, fans were starting to get increasingly concerned, because I think kind of history shows that once an elite player gets down inside that last year of his contract, usually it results in them leaving for nothing. And that was why I think this closed season was always going to be pivotal in terms of trying to find a resolution. And just in the last couple of weeks, they've managed to make that breakthrough. And then that led to, Julian Ward, Liverpool's new sporting director, flying out to the Greek island of Mykonos last week to sort out the final few details with Salah and his agent, and leading to that announcement late on Friday afternoon.
Yeah, any excuse to get out on a holiday at this time of the year, I'm sure. I'm sure they enjoyed that little soiree to Mykonos. Never have emojis been more important to Liverpool fans either. His agent has sort of been known for this throughout the time, but even the club got involved this time as well. It's a bit of a twist.
Yes. Well, it was funny, actually, over the weekend, reading back over the replies to Rami Abbas's, laughing emoji that he'd put out, I think about 2 hours before the official announcement on Friday. And because it's been a theme of this saga, the fact that he's made these kind of, I suppose, half cryptic posts on social media, I think most people kind of leapt to the conclusion that it was a, almost like a mocking response to their latest contract offer. And so he was inundated with choice words would be a nice way of putting it. And, do you know what? I think throughout this whole saga, Rami Abbas is, it's been water off a duck's back to him, really. I think I don't think it's bothered him being portrayed as this kind of pantomime villain, because I think
he enjoyed it. I think,
yeah, I think his mission was clear from the outset, to get the best possible deal for his client, and he will feel that he's done that in the end. Obviously, Liverpool got into the spirit of it late on, replying to his laughing emoji with a facepalm emoji, and then I think the official announcement was a few minutes after that. So all smiles and all laughs in the end. Relations weren't always that cordial throughout the process. No. But I think in the end, everyone got what they wanted. I think Salah got the deal that gives him the recognition that he is one of the greatest players in world football, and Liverpool get to keep their biggest asset for the peak years of his career, because it was a growing fear that they might lose him.
Yeah, you detailed in the piece how the difference between what Salah was expecting in terms of his status in world football and the deal that had initially been offered by Liverpool, how that sort of reflected a difference between the expectation of the player and the expectation of the club, maybe. So when you said at the top that Liverpool's owners decided to offer this increased contract deal to Salah, what has convinced them that they needed to do that then? And that's the thing that obviously has unlocked Salah signing this deal.
I think more than anything, it's just when you take a step back and you weigh it all up, you know, the choice was pretty stark for the owners. It was, you either make him an offer that is going to convince him to stay, or you accept the reality of losing him for nothing, you know, next summer. Because that, you know, Salah said towards the back end of last season, there's absolutely no chance I'm going anywhere this summer. I will definitely be a Liverpool player for 22, 23. And I think also, you know, there's always been this thing that, you know, you don't want to commit vast sums of money to players who, you know, once they're into their 30s, obviously Salah just turned 30, you know, recently. But I think the more you look at it, and I'm sure, you know, Liverpool's owners do turn heavily to the data. You know, you look at it, there's no sign of Salah slowing down. You know, it's, you know, what was, you know, 31 goals in all competitions last season. You know, it equaled his second best season ever for the club. You know, shared the golden boot with Son at Tottenham, you know, picked up the award for most top flight assists. Yes, there was a drop off in the final few months of the season, but, you know, I think that was to be expected, you know, after, you know, the emotional as well as physical for kind of fatigue, I think, kicked in on the back of losing the final of AFCON and then the playoff for the World Cup with Egypt as well. And the thing with Salah is he's incredibly durable. When you look, you know, he's averaging over 50 appearances a season for Liverpool, you know, since he arrived 5 years ago. You know, when you add all that up, you know, £350,000 a week for the next 3 years is about £55 million in wages, which, of course, that's a big commitment. But when you flip it round, you know, what could you, you know, you couldn't replace Mo Salah for £55 million. It, you know, it's it, in the end, you know, I think, you know, of course, it was a complex negotiation. But I think, you know, certainly I get the feeling that all parties are really happy with the outcome.
Was Sadio Mane leaving a factor?
Liverpool insist not. They would say that they were still keen to extend Sadio Mane's contract, and that the big difference between Salah and Mane was that where Salah's preference was always to stay, and it was just about the contract. Mane was reluctant to enter contract talks, and then, you know, it became increasingly clear that he wanted to embark on a new challenge and had this fantastic offer on the table from Bayern Munich that he wanted to take up. But yeah, I think there has to be an element of that as well when, you know, you see, you know, obviously Mane's wages have gone off the wage, but, you know, Divock Origi is another one who, you know, he would have been earning around £100,000 a week. He's obviously left on a free transfer as well. So that, you know, and Darwin Nunez will have come in on, you know, let certainly, you know, lower wages than Mane was on. So that certainly, I think, is, you know, certainly freed up, you know, probably a bit more kind of leverage in terms of the wage bill as well. And, you know, and if Liverpool have made the decision to divert those funds Salah's way, then I don't think anyone would argue with that decision.
Yeah, because obviously there's doubts over Roberto Firmino's long-term future now as well because of his contract running down. So the idea of losing Mane, Salah and Firmino, the three forwards that Liverpool, before probably this season, had really pinned their whole structure and team on, would have been quite a shift in one summer, wouldn't it, really?
Yeah. I think that's always been, you know, because this has been kind of like looming on the horizon for a couple of years, really. The fact that you know, Liverpool knew that Salah, Mane, Firmino all had contracts that expired in the summer of 2023. You know, it would have left too much of a void to have replaced, you know, all of them in quick succession. It had to be a gradual evolution of the front line. And
very expensive as well.
Yeah, very, you know, incredibly expensive. And I think it's worked out really well. I think when you know, Firmino's role has dwindled to the point where, you know, I don't think it would be the end of the world if he did go on a free next summer. You know, you look at obviously Diogo Jota has come in and kind of taken his place. Then you look at, you know, the impact to Luis Diaz in January. Now they've gone and signed Darwin Núñez for what could potentially be a club record fee. Yeah, it's a bit of a changing of the guard in that front line. The priority for Liverpool, you know, out of those, you know, the long established front three was always keeping Salah. You know, I remember someone at Liverpool saying to me about 18 months ago, you know, that Salah will be the one that they, you know, they kind of throw the kitchen sink at to do everything to stay. I think when you look at it, Mane got what he wanted with his move. You know, Liverpool haven't had to replace two big names in the same window. Now they've got Salah sorted out for the next 3 years. So, yeah, it's certainly been a busy start to Julian Ward's tenure as sporting director. But I think the great thing for Klopp is that, you know, a lot of those issues have been resolved before they've even reported back for pre-season.
Yeah, it's a bit of a contrast to Manchester United that we've just been talking about, certainly. You've done a mailbag that's on The Athletic at the moment for Liverpool fans. Firmino's future is one of the topics that you've covered in there. Also links to Jude Bellingham and an interest in maybe bringing him in next summer, which again points to just how organised Liverpool are in terms of their recruitment. I guess the one thing about the Salah contract, James, that may complicate things a little bit is his wage and the level of it going to affect Liverpool's opportunity to bring players in future, because is everyone not going to ask for slightly more now salary is being paid such a vast sum of money?
I mean, I think in the short term, I don't see any issues there in terms of, you know, I certainly don't think you're going to have players going and knocking on Julian Ward's door this week demanding that they get parity, because you know, I think when you look at it as well, the other kind of real elite players in that Liverpool squad, their contracts have still got a long period left on them. You think of, you know, Van Dijk, Trent Alexander-Arnold, people like that, to 2025. I think Alisson's till 2026. So no, and you know, from the feedback I've had, like a few of the players, you know, they're just buzzing the fact that Salah is sticking around, and their opinion seems to be that he deserves every penny. I think in terms of potential kind of business, Liverpool have indicated that they're pretty happy with what they got. That, you know, they've obviously, you know, getting a replacement in for Mane was the priority. They've done that with Núñez, and they've brought in two really gifted young players in Fabio Carvalho and Calvin Ramsey, who, you know, obviously will be Trent Alexander-Arnold's deputy. So I think probably the one kind of nagging area for that fans are still talking about is obviously, will they go and bolster their midfield with a central midfield signing? But no, you know, despite the fact that they do really like Jude Bellingham, you know, who wouldn't? But that is very much kind of with an eye on 2023 rather than this window.
Go and check out that mailbag article if you want to know more about everything going on at Liverpool at the moment. Of course, all the details on Mohamed Salah's deal and how it was signed over in Mykonos, the lucky men who sorted that in the sunshine. You can read more about it on The Athletic right now. Thanks, James.
Cheers, Ian.
Daly. It's England with a reprieve. And here's Hemp. Hemp plays it in, and Mina Rami has to put it in. A taken by the substitutes. A sweeping move from England.
The Athletic's women's football correspondent Charlotte Harper joins us now then to look ahead to the European Championships, which starts in just a couple of days' time now in England. Now, record crowds, star players, primetime coverage, a good chance of England doing well, certainly according to a computer, if nothing else. All the ingredients are there for a really exciting tournament, Charlotte.
Absolutely. World-class footballers, as you said, home nation, Wembley, Old Trafford, it should be a cracker, and I'm buzzing.
Yeah, I think we all are, in a sense, because I think there's far more focus on this tournament and the Euros than there's ever been before. Certainly when the tournament was held here in 2005, it's a totally different feel to this, isn't it?
Absolutely. Like, I don't remember watching Euro 2005. Like, I know it was on TV, but it wasn't as available as it is now. I mean, the WSL didn't even exist. At that tournament, you had 8 teams. This year, we've got 16. Players weren't full-time. It was hosted solely in the Northwest, whereas this year, we've got an array of stadiums, and I know we're going to come on to that. Nancy Frostick's article explaining the evolution from Euro 2005 mentioned that it was the first time players saw fans with their names on their back, and that was really impactful for them. So the difference 17 years ago is huge.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess as well, it helps that England are being tipped to do pretty well as well. They're being labelled as favourites by a simulator, I believe.
Yeah, so this is from Nielsen Grace Notes, which deals with data analysis. And what they do is they run the tournament over kind of a million times, simulations of the tournament. Now, you have to take it with a pinch of salt because the teams are ranked according to their FIFA rankings. But according to the simulation, England are the favourites, mainly because of that home advantage, and that gives them the extra boost, which I think is a really interesting talking point. Of course, home advantage, a huge number of fans backing you. But as we know with the men's side, if you're 2-0 down at a huge stadium and it gets a bit nervy in the first 20 minutes, you know, that can play against you at times. And I'm sure, you know, the Dutch will be in full support for their team, previous hosts in 2017. And they bring all manner of kind of orange. But again, data has shown tickets from Germany, France and all over the world. People are excited to see the best talent on show.
There's lots of Euros preview, of course, on The Athletic right now, including a look at the groups, a look at some of the squads and squad profiles and things like that. So, of course, head there if you want to know more about any of the players or any of the teams involved in this tournament. But in terms of this England side, who's exciting you the most?
Lauren Hemp, hands down, like, she's so exciting to watch, so threatening. As soon as she's on the ball, you know she's going to do something dangerous with it. It's her hips. Like, she just snakes through those defenders. and she's only 21. Named PFA Young Player of the Year four times so far. But she just takes it in her own stride. She's quite shy as a character. Keep your eye out for Lauren Hemp. It's an exciting England team, especially the attacking prowess we have with Beth Mead, Chloe Kelly coming back into the squad as well. But we've also got big character in Mary Earps in goal, captain Leah Williamson stepping up, Millie Bright, Lucy Bronze. And the influence of Serena Wiegmann as manager has been instrumental since her appointment in September.
Yeah, and there's been a lot said this week as well about the change in mindset that she's brought and the different sort of feel of... Phil Neville was quite an emotional coach, is how he was described, and Wiegmann's just brought a totally different approach to it. And do you think the fact that she's not English maybe helps a little bit? I mean, Millie Bright's been speaking about the mindset change that she's brought about. There's not that... There's a bit of a disconnect that maybe in the past when the English men's team had Sven-Goran Eriksson, he brought a totally different feel to, say, Kevin Keegan, who came before him.
Each manager brings their own style and their form of communication as well. Players weren't willing to kind of compare Phil Neville and Serena Wiegmann, which is the inevitable comparison to make. But what the players have said, that it's very clear what Serena Wiegmann wants from them. Every player knows their role. There's no grey areas. You know where you stand. And I think they really appreciate that transparency and honesty. I was in North Macedonia watching England in one of their World Cup qualifiers, and we sat down. Serena Wiegmann looked at her watch and said, "I've got 9 minutes until training starts, just to let you know."
You get an idea straight away then, don't you?
Exactly. Yeah, very warm, very friendly with the media, but also no messing around.
How long did the interview last?
8 minutes, 45 seconds.
So you fushed it as much as you could then. What about England aside then? Who else have you got your eye on in terms of the other favourites for the tournament?
I think Sweden are really, really strong contenders, especially since their silver medal in the Olympics last year. They're very flexible with their formation. They can adapt from that back four to a back three. Players like Chelsea captain Magdalena Eriksson, but also Aslani, Black Stenius from Arsenal, Rolfo from Barcelona, they're ones to watch. France and Spain, the quality of players on offer is exceptional. They are the best teams, I think, in terms of quality. On an individual basis, it's whether they can gel as a team and adapt to those uncomfortable situations when teams are putting you under pressure. They've also struggled in major tournaments. Like, they don't have semi-final, final experience in those senior ranks. Norway have a frightening front three of Guro Reiten of Chelsea and Graham Hansen from Barcelona and Ada Hegerberg. She is huge, having come back to international football for Norway. And she is a game changer who will put the ball in the back of the net.
Obviously, we've spoken about a lot of the positives for this tournament. There has been one criticism about some of the venues that the games are going to be played at. England, of course, start against Austria at Old Trafford, and there'll be a huge crowd for that, I'm sure. But some of the games in particular being played at places like the Manchester City Academy Stadium, which is a brilliant venue for women's football. And of course, the women's Manchester City team have used that in recent times. But at just 4,700 fans available to go to that game, is that the right sort of place for this tournament to be taking place?
So it was Iceland captain Sara Bjork, Gunnarsdóttir, who really spoke out the issue and said it's not the respect that they deserve. And it wasn't to do with the quality of the stadium. As you said, Manchester City women play there, brilliant stadium in terms of pitch surface. But the capacity is 4,700, and that's lower than the group game average of the 2017 Euros. And Iceland FA have said, you know, we could have sold that stadium over two or three times. So it is disappointing that there is such a low capacity, especially because standing terraces are not permitted in UEFA competitions. So that capacity has to be reduced if a temporary seating solution can be found. When I asked UEFA that, they said they weren't going to put necessarily plans in place for temporary seating. So it is a difficult strategy because UEFA wanted to go for a mix of stadiums. They wanted to sell out stadiums rather than have empty seats. And it is a tricky balance to strike, especially with the combination of stadiums you have on offer. So you've got from the Etihad, 4,700, Lee Sports Village, where Manchester United women play, but that's not in Manchester. You have to, you know, take public transport to get out there, and it's a trek. Then you're going up to the New York Stadium in Rotherham, 12,000, Brentford around 17,000, and then you start building with Milton Keynes, Brighton's Amex, Southampton at St Mary's, Sheffield, Bramall Lane, and finally Old Trafford, and then the final at Wembley. I think it's disappointing, and then they've undersold and underestimated the popularity of women's football. 500,000 tickets have been sold, and I hope that everyone who has bought a ticket turns up and supports the women's game. It's not just the stadiums that bid to host games. It has to be part of the local council and host cities, and the Southwest, Northeast, the West or East Midlands didn't submit a bid at all to host a Euros game. So, and they say a number of host cities couldn't commit because of either the unavailability of the stadium, refurbishments, concerts. Some host cities were focusing on this summer's Commonwealth Games or the Rugby League World Cup later on in the autumn, or a lack of financial support as well. You have to ask why those host cities didn't want to stage a game for Euros 2022, and I think the governing bodies should definitely be looking into that for the future.
All the stories we've discussed on today's podcast are, of course, on The Athletic right now, plus more. And remember, you can subscribe for just £1 a month right now. Head to theathletic.com/footballpod. But for the minute, thank you for everyone for coming on, and thank you for listening at home. Bye-bye.
The Athletic.